with that somewhat incongruous segue, we'll move to today's birthdays. On this February 16th, Barb and I would like to wish happy birthday to the following listeners: Jeff Cash of Cedar Falls, Wayne Eason of Orange City, Robert Russell Guyon of Winterset, Helen Ibarra of Clear Lake, Judy Maher of Cedar Rapids, and Edna Mathis of Stewart. So happy birthday. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television, on Iowa PBS, and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call here at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now, back to Barb for more news.
Actually, I'm turning to the obituaries. There were only two today. One is for William Billy Bowers of Altoona. He was 92, passed away on Tuesday, February 13th, 2024, and was born March 31 of 1931 in Runnels, Iowa, to his parents William and Lois Bowers in Runnels. Billy graduated from Runnels High School in 1949 and married Carolyn Bowers on November 20 of 1954, and they were members of the Runnels Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where he served as bishop agent to the church and was an avid to-the-penny accountant. In 2000, they started attending Adventure Life Church in Altoona. Billy attended the American Institute of Business and earned a degree in accounting. He worked for Interchange Power until they dissolved, and then for Ruan Transport for 35 years before retiring in 1993. He gave many years of service to the community of Runnels, serving as mayor for 17 years. And during his tenure, he helped with the sewer system installation and the construction of the Runnels Community Center and Runnels Area Park. Billy really enjoyed visiting with the community residents as mayor and was also a member of the Runnels Lions Club since 1956, in which he held a perfect attendance record for many years. The family will greet friends Saturday, February 17, 2024, from 1 to 2 p.m. at Hamilton's Altoona Funeral Home. That's at 105 4th Street, Southwest in Altoona, with a memorial service to begin at 2 p.m. Memorial contributions may be directed to Adventure Life Church or the Reynolds Historical Society. Online condolences may be made to hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. And then we have an updated services announcement for Katie May of West Des Moines. Those services will be held at Sacred Heart Church in West Des Moines on Monday, February 19, and visitation will be from 9 to 10 with a funeral mass to follow at 10 a.m., a private family burial in Rest Haven Cemetery will follow.
And we'll go back to the front page of Metro and Iowa section now. State Auditor Rob Sand says the Board of Parole cited Republican-backed law to deny him documents. This story by Stephen Gruber Miller. State Auditor Rob Sand says a state agency is citing a new Republican-backed law passed last year to deny his office access to documents. The Democrat Sand said his office received a tip that Iowa Board of Parole members were not attending all the hearings required by state law. When his office followed up, the board said it had fixed the problem but declined to provide Sand with records to support the claim. Sand said it's the first case of a government body denying records to his office, citing Senate File 478, a law passed last year that bars the auditor's office from going to court against another statewide elected official or state department, agency, board, or commission to enforce a subpoena for documents. State Auditor Sand said, last year, despite bipartisan opposition, the governor signed the most pro-corruption bill in Iowa history, allowing state agencies to hide documents from the auditor's office and the truth from you, the taxpayers. Today, we are issuing the first report telling the public that the truth remains hidden from them as a result of that law. The auditor's report, released Thursday, says the Board of Parole said the request was unrelated to its annual audit and declined to provide the records. The report states, citing Senate File 478, the board office refused to provide any information or the records to the auditor's office without a separate engagement letter. Marilee Mitchell, the Board of Parole's administrative secretary, provided a statement Thursday afternoon on behalf of the board. It read, audit engagement letters set out the rights and responsibilities of the parties to the audit for the benefit of both the auditor and the agency. This quote is attributed to the Iowa Board of Parole Chair Renee Schulte. It continued, as noted in the audit report, the Board of Parole requested an engagement letter as required in Iowa law. The auditor refused to provide one. But Colin Crompton, a spokesperson for Governor Kim Reynolds, said in a statement, the auditor may believe he's above the law, but he still has to follow it. Engagement letters are an industry standard, and it's concerning that he refuses to comply with it. The auditor's report says Sands' office met the criteria for beginning an office according to government auditing standards. The report says the auditor's office also obtained an engagement letter to conduct its annual audit of the state of Iowa, which includes the Board of Parole. Republicans have said the new law was intended to protect Iowans' personal information by preventing the auditor's office from accessing certain personal records, as well as to save taxpayer money by limiting government lawsuits. State Senator Mike Busolo, a Republican from Ankeny, said last year, it was intended to save taxpayer money with common sense principles like government shouldn't sue government. And if government can work out its differences through an arbitration process, then that makes a heck of a lot of sense. Rather than allowing the auditor's office to go to court, the law established a 3-person arbitration panel to decide disputes between the auditor's office and other state entities. The panel is made up of 1 member picked by the auditor's office, a 2nd member picked by the agency being audited, and a 3rd member picked by the governor. Sand said he did not choose to pursue arbitration in this case, saying that he's not sure there would be a point. He said, that panel would be 1 person from our office, 1 person from the Board of Parole, which works at the pleasure of the governor, and then the 3rd person chosen by the governor. I like efficiency in government, but I'm not here to clown around and waste people's time. Sand is the only Democrat elected to statewide office in Iowa. The legislature and the governor's office are controlled by Republicans. And Republican lawmakers are again considering scaling back the duties of the auditor's office this year. As Barb read earlier, on Wednesday, Senate Republicans advanced a new bill, Senate File 2311, that would allow state agencies and departments to employ a certified public accountant to perform their annual office audit rather than use the state auditor's office. The agency would then submit the results of the audit to the state auditor. Senator Busolo said this time, accountants believe they have a high ethical standard and can deliver this and would deliver it well with the flexibility that would bring efficiency and effectiveness to state government as well. Busolo said many local governments use certified public accountants to conduct their audits. Sand said that the bill would undermine the independent review provided by the state auditor's office by allowing agencies to hire the firm that audits them. He said, the purpose of Senate File 2311 is not to create a better system for taxpayers. It's to undermine an independently elected official of the state of Iowa and all of the people who work in this office for taxpayers. And it's to increase corruption in the state of Iowa.
Reynolds' bill to cut boards advances. By Stephen Gruber Miller. Iowa lawmakers are planning to reduce the number of state boards and commissions this year, but the extent of the cuts is still up for debate. Governor Reynolds has proposed a wide-ranging plan that would eliminate more than 100 boards and commissions, as well as repeal the requirement that boards and conditions have a balance of men and women serving. The Iowa Senate is advancing Reynolds' bill, Senate Study Bill 3172, but the House is moving a narrower bill, House Study Bill 710. that would eliminate about 49 boards and commissions, largely ones that one lawmaker describes as defunct or duplicated. Now, both chambers are controlled by Republicans. Now, what concerns are there about eliminating Iowa boards and commissions? Well, Iowans crowded into the Senate subcommittee room Wednesday to speak about the governor's bill, raising concerns about how it would affect a number of professional boards that govern multiple separate professions. And one of the changes would combine the Electrical Examining Board and Plumbing and Mechanical Systems Board and the State Building Code Board of Review into a single Building and Construction Occupations Board. We believe those boards should retain their autonomy going forward, said John Murphy, a lobbyist for the Iowa State Building and Construction Trades. They're productive, they're effective, and they are important in worker safety and, frankly, the safety of Iowans. Another change would eliminate the commissions on the status of African Americans, Asians, and Pacific Islanders, persons with disabilities, and the status of women, Native American affairs, and Latino affairs, and transfer those commissions' duties to the Human Rights Board, which would be reduced in size. Now, Keenan Crow, Policy and Advocacy Director for the LGBTQ rights group, One Iowa, raised concerns about grouping the different commissions together. These are all very disparate, which is why they are given different commissions, Crow said, and those community-specific commissions deserve to continue to represent those communities accordingly. Senator Chris Cornoyer, Republican of LeClaire, said that she appreciated the passionate comment that senators heard Wednesday and said that she plans to incorporate some of the feedback into an amendment to the bill. We are not seriously here to create legislation that's going to create issues in those professions or in those occupations or in these communities, she said. So I appreciate the comment, and I think that it's going to make it a better bill. Okay, so the House and the Senate take different tacks. In the House, the lawmakers passed their own bill through the State Government Committee Wednesday with bipartisan support. Representative James Bloomingdale, Republican of Northwood, who chairs the House Senate Governments Committee, said that her members didn't have time to consider the full bill filed by Reynolds. She said that she wanted to focus on areas where there would be more agreement, and she pleaded to keep working on the legislation. This isn't perfect. We all know that, she said, but I think it's good, and I will look to address a couple of the concerns that were brought up. While the vote on the Senate bill split along party lines, House Democrats were largely supportive of their chamber's version. I really appreciate your efforts that have gone into this, talking to stakeholders, talking to the minority party, making this a bipartisan effort, the Representative Adam Zabner, Democrat, Iowa City, said to Bloomingdale. I think this bill is much stronger than what's going on over in the Senate. Senator Janice Weiner, Democrat, Iowa City, urged the Senate to take up the House's bill and use it as a starting point rather than the governor's proposal. She said the shorter House subcommittee meeting on Wednesday showed the House has done a better job than the Senate at dealing with any concerns about the bill. A lot of people who were here today weren't there because their concerns have already been met, she said. Cornoyer said that she expects to work with the House on amending the bill as it moves forward. I think we're going to start with the governor's bill and potentially with this amendment dial back based on some of the feedback that we've gotten from the public. So hopefully we'll work with the House to meet in the middle somewhere. Reynolds's recommendation. Their recommendations come from a committee established as part of a massive state government reorganization plan that she signed into law last year that reduced cabinet-level state government agencies from 37 to 16. The law established a boards and commissions review committee, which met several times last year to develop a report with recommendations which formed the basis for Reynolds' proposal. Reynolds' bill would eliminate 111 of Iowa's 256 boards and commissions while leaving 145 in place, which is a 43% reduction. The bill would also require every remaining board and commission to be reviewed once every 4 years going forward to determine whether it should continue to exist. Molly Severn, a legislative liaison and a deputy chief of staff for Reynolds, said that the review process would prevent unchecked growth of the number of boards and commissions in the state. Gender balance repeal could be passed as a separate bill. Reynolds' current bill does contain language eliminating the gender balance requirement for boards and commissions, but Knoyer said that the Senate may remove that language. That's because senators are also moving a separate bill, Senate File 2096, that would eliminate the gender balance requirement for boards and commissions. I think it's likely that we might be removing that because it's being covered in another bill, she said. We'll see. According to the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics, about 50% of Iowa county boards and commissions had achieved gender balance between 2013 and 14. Between 2021 and 22, it was about 62%, an important but still far short of all.
And the fourth and final story on the front page of today's Metro in Iowa section, could the Des Moines Metro become a BMX hub? Organizers look for a study on finding a site for a possible indoor BMX track. This story by Philip Sitter. Organizers seeking to build a BMX track in the Des Moines Metro are asking for help paying for a study to determine details of the proposal, including where the track might go. And there are two artists' renditions with this story. One is a rendering showing an indoor BMX track that organizers want to build in the metro, possibly in West Des Moines. Then this is a rendering by Newman Monson Architects and was sent to the Register, and it shows three young people on bicycles in the front, in the foreground, about to take off down an indoor track with others in the background, and some bleachers along the side and a suspended roof overhead. Among the leaders of this effort is John Lichtig, board president of Iowa Central BMX, whose son is a BMX racer. Lichtig said, currently, we travel as much as we can to get in as much racing as we can during the winter. We have spent the last 4 weekends on the road and will spend again this weekend on the road. Then we have a weekend off, and then we go to a national event. Lichtig said there are probably about 100 BMX racers of all ages in the Des Moines area. All that travel and the cost makes the prospect of having a local year-round indoor venue appealing, he said. He and other organizers also foresee it becoming a destination for people from 4 hours in every direction, serving not just BMX racers and freestylists, but also mountain bikers and the entire cycling community. Luke Hoffman, executive director of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, which is partnering on the project, said the track could be a place to host educational and advocacy programs. The immediate goal is to raise $47,000 for a feasibility study. Newman Monson Architects has contributed early renderings for the project, which show an airy, skylighted arena with room for both BMX courses and spectators. The goal of the feasibility study is to identify a potential location for the track, come up with a design that can serve riders of all skill levels, and devise a sustainable business plan. According to the Iowa Central BMX fundraising page for the project, CSL International, a sports, entertainment, convention, and leisure industry consultancy, has been tapped to conduct the study. Bobby Kennedy, operations manager at Des Moines Street Collective and a member of the West Des Moines Bicycle Advisory Commission, said he has been talking to West Des Moines city officials about the idea, but the track could be located somewhere else in the metro, depending on what the feasibility study says. Kennedy says, I want to keep it accessible and affordable. I want normal people to be able to go there. The beauty of BMX and mountain biking is that you don't really need a fancy bike. You can go out and have fun on anything. Lichtig said once the study starts, it could take 6 months to complete. BMX stands for Bicycle Motocross, and it includes racing as well as freestyle. The sport gained attention in the early 1970s in Southern California and made its Olympic Games debut in 2008 in Beijing. USA Cycling says BMX riders are tested on dirt tracks with rollers, jumps, and turns to challenge their skills. Tracks can range from about 900 feet to 1,300 feet long. USA BMX, which claims to have more than 70,000 members, says there are in excess of 370 tracks across the U.S. and Canada. USA BMX lists three tracks in Iowa, including the outdoor 8035 BMX track at 1701 East McKinley Avenue in Des Moines, but only one is indoors, Mississippi Valley BMX Raceway in Davenport, about a 2.5 hour drive from Des Moines. Housed in a cavernous building on the Mississippi Valley Fairgrounds, Lichtig said it's a throwback to the way that BMX racing used to be, which was flat track, flat corners, basically. So you're in a warehouse, and then you put in wood jumps, hay bales in the corner. That's where he and his son have spent the past three weekends. He said they like it, but the Des Moines organizers are looking to build something more sophisticated. Lichtig said, "I think our vision is a full-blown dirt racetrack, asphalt corners, a full-on BMX racetrack inside, along with spaces for pump bikes, which riders propel on wave-like rollers without pedaling, and for demonstrating dirt jumping and mountain biking skills." Lichtig said, "We're thinking big. We want this to be world-class. I think this can be an epicenter for those kids that are looking for something and just haven't found it." Kennedy said he wants the track to become a living, breathing hub for the cycling community.
And now we turn to 50 states. Alabama, Montgomery. The Alabama Senate voted to put a politically appointed board in control of the Alabama Department of Archives and History, a change proposed after some lawmakers were upset about the department hosting a lecture on LGBTQ plus history. And Oroville, California, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is urging the voters to approve a ballot initiative that he says is needed to tackle the state's homelessness crisis, a change social providers say would threaten programs that keep people from becoming homeless in the first place. And in the District of Columbia, Washington, Colin Jost, the co-author of Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, will get a chance in April to roast leading political and media figures as the featured entertainer at the annual dinner of the White House Correspondents Association. And in Atlanta, Georgia, a nuclear power plant in Georgia has begun splitting atoms in the second of its two new reactors, Georgia Power said. And a key step toward providing carbon-free electricity. And in Nebraska, Lincoln, a Nebraska lawmaker who tanked an effort last year by his fellow Republicans to pass a near-total abortion ban, has given top priority this year to a bill that would allow abortions beyond the state's 12-week ban in cases of fetal anomalies. And one more here, or maybe more. Let's see, in New York, New York. Its schools and public hospital system announced a lawsuit against the tech giants that run Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube, blaming their addictive and dangerous social media platforms for fueling a childhood mental health crisis that is disrupting learning and draining resources.
And we'll finish up with a tour of some of the bordering states around Iowa. News from the 50-state roundup in the USA Today. In Illinois, Peoria, the annual July 3rd fireworks show at Glen Oak Park could come to an end or see major changes as the Peoria Park District explores how the event can move forward safely. In Kansas, Hutchinson County Community College, Butler Community College, and Garden City Community College are all following Kansas law on funding for out-of-state student-athlete scholarships, auditors announced recently. Up in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, health officials have found that municipal water supply likely sparked an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. Since April 2023, 14 cases of the lung disease have been confirmed in the Grand Rapids, Minnesota area, according to a release from the state's health department. In Jefferson City, Missouri, the state Supreme Court rejected the latest attempt by Republican state officials to block taxpayer dollars from going to Planned Parenthood, citing a failure in the state's legal appeal. In Pierre, South Dakota, it's the first time in years that former Attorney General Jason Ramsburg has publicly addressed his fatal accident that killed a man in September of 2020. In testimony that came under the scrutiny of South Dakota's highest court, Ramsburg, his lawyers, and the State Bar of South Dakota Disciplinary Board presented their formal oral arguments about whether the impeached official should lose his law license for a retroactive 26-month period ending in August of 2024. And finally, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A new neuroscience institute has launched in Milwaukee with a focus on caring for people of all ages with neurological issues and advancing neurosciences through clinical trials and research. Well, for the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb Martin and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure to read for you. We're going to take a short break now and let our next readers slide into place here in the studio. And we hope that you stay safe in the snow and the cold and have a great weekend.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman and myself, Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And now here's Jim with our first article.
Thank you, Scott, and good morning, everyone. We're reading from the USA Today opinion page to start off. And we have an article here written by Sarah Pequeno. And she is an elections columnist for USA Today. Voices of those killed by guns haunt Congress. Gun violence is a uniquely American problem. The death rate in 2021 was 7 times that of Canada's and 340 times higher than the rate within the United Kingdom. The United States is the only peer nation where gun violence is the leading cause of death for children. Our children spend part of their lives learning how to hide during active shooter drills. Generation Z, in particular, dubbed the Lockdown Generation, has learned to be wary of movie theaters, concerts, nightclubs, and places of worship due to the tragedies we have seen occur in these spaces. Now Generation Alpha is getting past the same traumas. Unfortunately, the reality is that Congress continuously fails to protect us from this horror. They just keep looking away. A campaign released Wednesday is asking whether they will ignore the voices of victims. Congress has ignored U.S. gun violence. Last year, Congress ignored 656 mass shootings and more than 43,000 gun violence deaths. Congress has ignored the more than 360,000 students who have experienced gun violence at school since the mass shooting at Colorado's Columbine High School in 1999, according to data collected by the Washington Post. Congress has also ignored that more than half of 2021 deaths involving gunfire were suicides. Another sizable chunk, 43%, were homicides. More than 80% of all murders in the United States in 2021 involved a gun. No legislation was passed to help make those numbers go down. Sure, there was bipartisan legislation signed into law in 2022, the first major gun safety legislation in nearly three decades. But it was relatively weak, mainly incentivized states to pass their own laws and expanding on existing legislation that keeps domestic abusers from owning firearms. Wednesday was the six-year anniversary of a gunman killing 17 people at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. It is the deadliest shooting at a high school in U.S. history, surpassing the 13 killed at Columbine. March for Our Lives, the gun control advocacy group created in the wake of the Florida tragedy, is recognizing the anniversary by letting the victims of gun violence speak to members of Congress directly through artificial intelligence. The group rolled out the project Wednesday morning on Capitol Hill. It's been 6 years and you've done nothing. Not a thing to stop all of the shootings that have continued to happen since, says the voice of Joaquin Oliver. The thing is, I died that day in Parkland. My body was destroyed by a weapon of war. I'm back today because my parents used AI to recreate my voice to call you. Other victims like me will be calling too. Oliver is one of six voices recreated for the Shotline, a website that uses these AI-generated monologues to call elected officials and demand gun control legislation. The voices were created using audio and video clips from the family members of the victims, the people who have repeatedly asked Congress for action, to no avail. The project is spearheaded by Manny Oliver, Joaquin's father, and the co-founder of Change the Ref, alongside his wife, Patricia. Thoughts and prayers must always be followed by action. Hearing each of the victims' voices is unsettling, but it's supposed to be. What is more unsettling is that we have reached a point where recreating the voices of the dead might be one of the only ways to capture the attention of members of Congress. They're not acting, Giselle Webster, whose son JC is one of the voices, says of Congress. They'll tell you, oh, you're in my thoughts and prayers. Now, I'll tell you, thoughts and prayers, they do work, but the thoughts and prayers must always be followed by action. Other voices include Ethan Song, a 15-year-old killed by an unsecured gun at a friend's house in 2018. Mike Bond, a man who died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound in 2014. Aquila Da Silva, a 23-year-old who was killed in a mass shooting at a Waffle House in 2018. And Uzziah Garcia, a 10-year-old fourth grader, killed in the 2022 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. March for Our Lives is asking Congress to pass universal background checks, a ban on assault weapons, and legislation like Ethan's Law, named after Song, which would set national requirements for safe firearm storage. The advocacy group is also supporting the Protecting Kids from Gun Marketing Act, introduced by Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts, that would require the Federal Trade Commission to regulate gun marketing toward minors, just like alcohol and tobacco are regulated. These voices provide a reminder that the victims of gun violence are more than statistics. They are real people, in many cases, young people, whose lives were cut short because of Congress's failure to act after other mass shootings. Excuse me. Webster, whose son JC was almost 21 when he was fatally shot in 2017, says she wants Congress to know her child's point of view. You've heard about this shooting. You've heard about this and that. That's who I am. You would not listen to my parents, to friends, family, students. Now you're going to listen to me. It's unthinkable that anyone could ignore the pleas of those directly affected by gun violence. It is what has gotten us to this point where recreating the victims' voices might be one of the only ways to actually get lawmakers to pay attention to the pain caused by a lack of gun laws in this country. At the very least, hearing these voices should remind Congress that these families and advocates will not give up until better gun laws are passed.
Thank you, Jim. Our next opinion is entitled Beyoncé's Country Music Album Has a Twang of Conspiracy. It's written by Rex Hupke of USA Today. And Rex is a columnist, and you can follow him on X, formerly called Twitter, at Rex Hupke, and on Facebook at facebook.com/Rex is a jerk. The sensible conspiracy theories about President Joe Biden rigging the NFL and setting Taylor Swift up to endorse him on the Super Bowl stage didn't pan out as we expected. But as a patriotic supporter of Donald Trump and a person with enormous amounts of time on my hand and no one who loves me enough to get me to stop, I've sifted out the real plan. The Biden administration is now using Beyoncé to destroy country music by making it good. That's right. During the Super Bowl, the superstar released two new tracks from her upcoming album, which, to the surprise of many, is a country album. The songs Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages are all twang and banjo and hoedown and rugged whiskey and, most concerning of all, really good. The last thing red-blooded Americans who enjoy the processed cheese marginality of most country music need is something coming along and showing them what good music sounds like. Clearly, Biden and his nefarious socialist handlers have directed Beyoncé to take this foray into the world of country, hoping it will turn Trump-supporting country music fans into brainwashed liberal drones. Consider the facts. A 2020 study by Coleman Insights Media Research found that among consumers who have a positive opinion of Trump, half of their top 100 favorite songs are from the country genre. For those who have positive opinion of Biden, the number drops to 10%. It seems obvious, if you don't think about it, that by having Beyoncé record a country album, the Biden regime is forcing country music fans to realize that their favorite artists, with the notable exception of Dolly Parton, have been doing it wrong for decades. That will either depress voter turnout in the 2024 presidential election due to an overabundance of tears in beers, or, in a worst-case scenario, transform well-meaning conservative country fans into raging liberals who eat vegan ribs and drive electric pickups and whatnot. 18% of Americans believe a Taylor Swift conspiracy. Why not a Beyoncé one? I'm sure the same people who thought the Taylor Swift conspiracies were hooey will say this sounds like another example of right-wing weirdos cooking up something ridiculous, because if they don't have a thing to be mad at, they might have to stop and reflect on how lonely they are. But according to a new Monmouth University poll, about 1 in 5 Americans believe the singer Taylor Swift is part of a covert effort to help President Joe Biden win the 2024 election. Patrick Murray, director of the independent Monmouth University Polling Institute, said, "The supposed Taylor Swift PSYOP conspiracy has legs among a decent number of Trump supporters, even many who hadn't heard about it before we polled them accept the idea as credible. Welcome to the 2024 election." Welcome, indeed. If 18% of Americans buy into the Swift PSYOP, you better believe at least 25% will get on board with the Beyoncé is coming to show you that Jason Aldean is hot garbage conspiracy. Country station refused to play Beyoncé's song. It didn't go well. Resistance to the Biden-led Letting Beyoncé Prove Country Music is Pretty Mid campaign has already begun. A country music radio station in Oklahoma rejected a request to play Beyoncé's Texas Hold'em this week, saying, "We do not play Beyoncé on KYKC as we are a country music station." Predictably, that didn't end well, as Beyoncé's legions of fans in the Beehive swarmed angrily. By Tuesday afternoon, the station was playing the song. "Don't you see what they're doing, sheeple? By dispatching one of the world's most talented performers into the country music sphere, the liberals are all but cementing a Biden re-election. This is Biden's craftiest conspiracy yet."
Thanks, Scott. And turning to sports, we have a TV schedule. There's a lot of things scheduled. I'll hit some of them that might interest you. Auto racing, NASCAR is on this afternoon at 2 p.m. our time, FS1. It's the Craftsman Truck Series. And at 3:30, following the other race, is the NASCAR Xfinity Series practice for Daytona International Speedway. We have college baseball starting at 2 o'clock on the Major League Baseball Network. You have the Major League Baseball Desert Invitational. Boston College plays Ohio State. And at 7 o'clock, Kansas State plays against California. College basketball, 6 o'clock this evening, CBS Sports Network. Villanova is at Georgetown. On ESPN2, VCU, Virginia Commonwealth, is at St. Louis. ESPNU Manhattan is at Iona. And then at 8 o'clock, Ohio is at Toledo. And at 9 o'clock, New Mexico at San Diego State on FS1. College women's basketball, 7 o'clock. We have the Pac-12 Network. Colorado plays Utah. College hockey at 8 o'clock, CBS Sports Network. Denver is at Minnesota in Duluth. College softball, 9 o'clock, ESPNU. We have Georgia versus Oklahoma State. College wrestling, 6 o'clock, Ohio State against Michigan State. And at 7:30, North Carolina at Virginia on the ACC network. Horse racing for you fans, FS2 at 2 o'clock. New York Racing Association, America's Day at the Races, and a couple of NBA highlights here. At 6 o'clock on ESPN, the NBA All-Star Friday, Ruffles NBA All-Star 2024 Celebrity Game in Indianapolis, and at 8 o'clock on TNT, the NBA All-Star Rising Stars Game. The semifinals and final come from Indianapolis. And a little article here, but highlighting the athletes of the week. Cedar Rapids Kennedy, girls basketball player Kyla Wright, and Pleasant Valley boys swimmer Owen Childs were voted the Register Iowa Ortho Athlete of the Week winners for the week of February 5 to 11. Wright won Female Athlete of the Week with 60% of the vote. Panorama girls basketball player Time Botker came in second with 35%. Wright came up clutch for the Cedar Rapids girls basketball team during a 79-78 victory over 4A number 11 Marion on Saturday in Cedar Rapids. She finished the night with 30 points after making 10 of 20 field goals, including 4 of 6 from beyond the arc and 6 free throws. She also was a force on defense, recording 6 steals during the game. Childs won Male Athlete of the Week with 62% of the vote. Iowa City West boys swimmer Holden Carter took second with 12%. Childs won 4 gold medals for Pleasant Valley during the boys state swimming meet finals on Saturday in Iowa City. He took first individually in the 100-yard freestyle with a time of 43.32 seconds, and the 100 backstroke in 47.64 seconds. Childs also swam the lead leg on Pleasant Valley's winning 200 freestyle relay team that finished in 1 minute 22.95 seconds, and he anchored the Spartans to win the 400 freestyle relay with a time of 3 minutes 3.06 seconds.
Thank you, Jim. Well, as you probably well know, the high school state wrestling tournament is going on this week at Wells Fargo Arena, and there are a number of stories that come out of that tournament, but this one is kind of fun. Rowdy Neighbor has the best name in wrestling and is ready to win state. It's written by Eli McCown of the Des Moines Register. It's on page 5B. All Burnett's Spirit Squad on mat 7 for bout number 129 of Class 1A at the boys' state tournament had a fairly noticeable grins on their faces. For the unknowing, it didn't make a lot of sense why the group appeared so eager for the wrestler to take the mat. However, one quick look at the name of the wrestler at 120 pounds suddenly made it all so clear. Introducing Rowdy Neighbor. Make no mistake about it, the junior has got the most unique name at this year's state tournament and maybe in Iowa sports, period. As Neighbor began his match, the cheerleaders led with a "Let's get rowdy," showcasing how much of a huge benefit his name is to the cheer squad. The origins of his first name begin with his older brother, Brody. Rowdy's brother was of the rambunctious sort, so his parents assumed Rowdy would be too. So, they donned him with one of the most creative names in the sport to try and match what they thought his personality would be like. From then and up until middle school, it was a perfect choice. All Burnett wrestling coach Clayton Rush came to the school in 2016 and has known Neighbor since he was in elementary school. When he heard the name, he was naturally curious to find out why, and he fairly quickly did. When he was in elementary school and middle school, the name fit him perfectly, Rush said. Being a wrestler, it probably shouldn't come as too much of a surprise that the name suits him. Even Rowdy admits that outside of his one exception, he lives up to his billing. From time to time, I can be rowdy, Neighbor said, just usually not during wrestling season when I'm being sucked down by the weight cut, but yeah, I usually am. The ability to get the rowdiness out before getting on the mat has been key to his success during his career. Even though he can be a rambunctious and fun guy off the mat at times, he's fairly even-keeled on it. In his freshman season, Neighbor finished in eighth place at state tournament despite having the flu. He spent time vomiting just off to the side of the mats between matches, but he still managed to get to the podium. In year two, without a flu bug bogging him down, he made a statement by reaching the finals of the 113-pound class. On the way, he defeated then reigning champion and number one seeded Eli Becerra of Missouri Valley to make his already eye-popping name stand out even more. In his first finals appearance, Neighbor fell to Akron Westfield's Cale Morrow by a major decision. It was a disappointing end for what still was a fantastic season. Now he's using it as fuel. "I let the moment get too big," Neighbor said. "I just got to remember that it's just another match and just another tournament." Thus far in his junior season, it's fairly evident how much it's driving him. He's a number one seed at 120 pounds, racking up a 50-win, 2-loss record through the regular season and day one of the boys' state tournament. In his first and only match on Wednesday, he pinned Riverside's Kellen Oliver as the buzzer sounded in the second period. There, he showed his skills of being on top by rolling Oliver onto his back on multiple occasions before finally getting a win by fall. He's got a tough road ahead of him in his class, with several tough contenders potentially waiting for him down the line. If seeding holds, he would get a rematch with Becerra, a senior who will no doubt be looking for some revenge with a bit of extra urgency to perform. "That'd be exciting, knowing that he wants that match back, but I'm pretty confident," Neighbor said. In the finals, the matchup, if seeding held, would be against Morrow, the one that held him from being a state champion last year. If he can pull it off, it would certainly be a storybook ending to his junior season. Despite that, Rush is mainly proud of his wrestler for one thing, and that's the person he has become. As a father, Rush's kids are often around the wrestling program. Most of them, particularly his 4-year-old daughter, took to Neighbor as their role model. As someone who did live up to that rowdy name growing up, his growth on and off the mat is what stands out about this star wrestler. Rush's children get to learn that just because you're a high-level athlete, it doesn't mean you get to act a certain way, Rush said. You still treat people with respect, and that's what he does with my kids. Now it's time for Dear Abby. Jim, why don't you go ahead and read that?
Thanks, Scott. Letter this morning. "Dear Abby, I am engaged to an amazing guy. We've been together a little more than 2 years. During our first year, his family was great to me. They acted as if they liked me. However, things have changed. When my fiance and I are around them, they just wave and have little to say to me, if they say anything at all. They never call or text me. I'm always the one to do it first. Several times when I have texted, they haven't replied. My fiancé is very supportive. He tells me things will get better and tries to make me feel better about it. But I'm starting to get the impression they don't like me. Also, I don't feel I have anything in common with his mother and sister, which makes me feel even more awkward. I have tried to be friendly and to nurture a relationship with them, but I'm getting no effort in return. If you have any advice, please share. Signed, Unliked in Kentucky. Dear Unliked, if you and your fiancé have a good relationship, stop obsessing about his family. They may have made a fuss over you in the beginning because they were new. Now a year has passed and the novelty has worn off. I'm sorry your relationship with his family hasn't turned out to be what you envisioned it would be. But life can be like that. So take this step by step. Nurture the relationships you have with friends, other couples, and your own family. Relax, enjoy the life you are building with the man you love, and take your cues for dealing with your future in-laws from your fiancé. He knows them better than we do." The second letter, "Dear Abby, my stepson, who had bipolar died by suicide a year and a half ago when we were away. We thought he was doing better and his mom saw no reason to stay at our house while we were gone for a few days. The police told us he had made his decision and there was nothing we could have done. This was my husband's youngest, and he lived with us for 12 years. I grew quite fond of him, but I wasn't with him for the first 18 years of his life. I'm still grieving, but my husband is grieving more. He had a heart attack 5 months to the day after his son's suicide, and then open-heart surgery. As my friend said after visiting him yesterday, that's depression to the nth degree. He doesn't see the need for therapy, and he hates extra medication. What can I do? Sign concerned for him in Texas. Dear Concerned, tell your husband you are still grieving the loss of your stepson, and you know he is too. Explain that you have a strong suspicion that his recent heart attack may have been connected to the tragic loss of his son. His doctor should be put on notice if they don't already know the whole story. If your husband is adamant about not getting grief counseling, tell him you are joining a grief support group and you need him to accompany you because you love him and don't want to lose him too.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Dave Buzik and Barb Martin. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.